And in three. Oh, I forgot to put this up. Jeez. You know what? This is not a good way to start the last show of the year, Jonathan. You know what? We'll just do the intro and I'll put it up as we go. In three, two, one. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Guide to the Grind. My name is Jeff Eady. Joining me, as always, is one of my favorite people, one of Canada's favorite mortgage brokers, and the Mar Murtaugh to my rigs, Mr. Jonathan Tilger. Jonathan, how are you today?
A little Lethal Weapon throwback there. I like that one. I'm doing awesome. Yourself?
I'm good. You know what? I figured I'd throw it out there because it is our last episode of the year. It's Christmas time. This is actually the end of our third season, Jonathan, which is pretty crazy. And everybody talks about sorry, I'm trying to do too many things at once. Everybody talks about how Die Hard is a Christmas movie, and yet Lethal Weapon is every bit as much of a Christmas movie as Die Hard. Here we go. I've got there. You can see the beginning card there. Anyhow, today I am super excited to have a guest joining us all the way from Chicago, Illinois. I'm just pulling up his bio here. I swear Kyle is usually much more smooth than this. There's something you jinxed us coming on with the mic. But he is There we go. He is managing partner and portfolio manager at Grizzly Rock Capital. Kyle founded the firm in 2012 and is responsible for the firm's investment management. With 16 years of investment management experience, he began his career at PAMCO, a leading fund of hedge funds, where he served as analyst. Subsequently, he invested directly in media and telecom companies at Macdonnell Asset Management and has a massive pedigree. Worked for BMO Capital, has been in the business for a long time. He holds an MBA from Chicago University, from University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, with concentrations in finance, accounting, entrepreneurship. He holds a BA in economics with a minor in poli sci from UCLA. Please welcome to the show Mr. Kyle Mowry. Kyle, how are you today?
Good day, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for being on the show. The one thing I did get right is the intro. I just had to skip a little bit of it there. Kyle, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do and what brings you to the show?
Yep. So we are fundamental small cap investors that focus in North American equities. We're based out of Chicago, and we've been operating. This will be the end of 12 years. So we've been in it for a while, and yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity broadly in small caps, and certainly under focused on versus large cap and large cap tech.
So
So,
when you talk about small cap, like just sort of broaden what you mean, just because I'm sure there's people listening who don't exactly know what small cap is, what mid cap is, and so forth. So if you could expand on that, just to help them out.
yeah, I would just say that like everybody's talking about the Magnificent Seven right now. Those are wonderful businesses. They are some of the largest businesses in the world, but there's thousands of businesses that are flying under the radar that are publicly listed that anyone can buy. That could be 500 million of market cap. It could be a billion of market cap, 2 billion, right? These are real companies with real innovative products and services. However, most aren't paying attention to them because the performance of large cap has just simply been better. And so for that reason, they're sort of overlooked and neglected.
And also all the large cap ultimately started out as small cap one day, or once upon a time they started at. And so it could be a possibility where you invest in it now when it grows to that stage.
Yeah, it requires knowing the business and then holding it is sometimes harder than finding it. It takes a lot of persistence not to sell, especially to lock in nice gains if you have them. So
What's kind of your timeline when you guys are looking at investing in a company?
yeah, so we're a bit of a cross between, a traditional fund manager who might be a little bit more short-term oriented and someone who has a, an infinite time horizon. We typically look at 2 to 4 years out. We're looking for inflections in the business operating performance, which translates to the financial performance. So over 2 to 4 years, if the business, inflects positively, hopefully the stock will reflect that, and our investors will make money.
So you're only investing in publicly traded companies?
Primarily, we can do privates and we have, but it's public is our focus.
Yeah. And so you guys mainly just buy stock in it, or do you actually, I guess you said equity, so you guys work with the companies themselves?
Yeah, we do. But and also I manage and run our business. I started out by myself, one man band, no longer the case, thank goodness. But I am an entrepreneur in that way, of an asset management business as well.
You know what? Let's yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Jonathan.
Gonna say you mentioned the word you said when the companies, I think the word you said was inflect. Was that the correct word?
Yes, inflect.
What is it you mean when you say that? And I guess that leads to what are the criteria you're looking for when you're putting money into a company?
Yeah, inflect is just a fancy way to say earnings growth, right? In terms of, a lot of businesses have these periods where they're growing earnings, but they're also, excuse me, growing revenue, but they're also growing expenses. And then they can kind of hit this period where, for whatever reason, their business finally kind of hits scale, or at least new products kind of take off, and either the margin is accretive to earnings or there's operating leverage in the business. Operating leverage is one of those things that is wildly misunderstood out there, in a world that likes to look at things on a, price to sales basis. Heck, sometimes it feels like people use that more than, earnings yields, the way that we sort of grew up, or, the old ways, the Graham and Dodd, Buffett sort of methodologies. So, operating leverage and earnings inflections in free cash flow, that can be wildly profitable if you can get them, before Wall Street. Wall Street has this bad habit of looking out, 12 months for things that have cash flow, and a decade for things that don't, right? So there's a sweet spot that's kind of in the middle there, where, we think we can kind of find some opportunity.
Are you finding more optimism in the market coming into 2024 than we did this time last year?
Well, if we had this call a month ago, I would have said no. But now, I mean, markets only go up. It's very reminiscent of early 2021, quite frankly. There's been a massive rise in valuations, especially in lower quality businesses. And by lower quality, I mean lower cash flows to, either no cash flows or low cash flows to enterprise value. So there's been a speculative mania the last month for sure. Not to say that good businesses haven't gone up in price too, but the lower the quality businesses have actually gone up far more in price than those of higher quality.
So you spoke about in there about kind of the difference between looking at and how Wall Street looks at a company where you say they're either looking, as you said, 12 months out of what their earnings, or for a company who is in that growth phase, give them a decade. So how is it that you differentiate, and what are some of the criteria you look to, I'll say, companies that are not profitable as of yet but are on a growth trajectory? Which ones do you say, hey, that one's one you want to go in, versus, you know what, let's stay away from this one?
Yeah, I think the studying unit economics and really understanding the business's product and service, and then breaking it down to the profit per unit, is something that's wildly underutilized, right? Like, it's wonderful to see, a company that's growing revenue. It's very easy to grow revenue. It's very hard to grow profit. And to do that, you have to grow profit at each individual unit. So if you can take a company, break it down to its unit economics focus, and then understand where that operating leverage point is when, the gross margins per unit are there, and then all of a sudden, you're going to be catapulting earnings far higher. That's something with requires, it requires effort to study it, but it's not in and of itself difficult to do. It does require significant effort. And Wall Street has a bad habit of being sloppy with respect to extrapolating current trends. And so what we're looking for those earnings inflections that are not encapsulated in Wall Street's, numbers out, 2 to 4 years, rather than, everybody's focused on the first, next year, maybe one or two quarters past that. Numbers are fairly precise. After that, it gets to be a pretty much a finger in the air for a lot of companies.
Well, because I know there's a lot of companies where, I mean, Tesla, for instance, because Tesla took years and years before they started showing a profit, and I know they're starting to show profits now, but even with that, their price to earnings is I'll just say so out of range with other auto manufacturers. And so that's one for myself I don't quite understand. I know there's other pieces in play that it's beyond me, so I'm not going to go into that. But looking at like Uber, that's another company where I don't think they're still profitable at this stage. I could be wrong. I don't follow it daily, but just at a high level, I like to check in periodically. What are your thoughts on those types of plays? And are those things that you are just, hey, pass on? Or do you go in on some of those saying you understand when they're going to start showing profits and what it's going to look like?
Yeah, so let's take Uber. I think most people, including myself, use Uber. It's a very wonderful business as a consumer. Or, you know, it's convenient. And, you know, for a lot of people like myself that live in a city, you know, it takes the place of a second car. I got kids, so I have one car, but we don't have a second car at the moment. So we, you know, rideshare is a great option. So they're making profit on a gross margin basis right now on every ride, but they are, you know, that's a network effects business, and a network effects business is two-sided. And so it's a winner take all or winner take most, right? So functionally, you're going to have Uber and Lyft, and maybe there'll be some regional players here and there. But Uber and Lyft have taken the targetable addressable market and sort of dominated it, right? So now they continue to invest in the business, but at some point, those businesses will become a free cash flow machine, and their investors will ultimately value the business on cash flow. It's probably not now. That's not a business that my pencil is sharp on in terms of that. That's a large cap business. We focus on small cap, so it's just not in our sandbox. But that being said, wonderful business. And at some point, the earnings will absolutely inflect as the SG&A, the OPEX kind of remains steady, and the gross profit just continues to rise on a per user increasing basis, different countries, maturation of the business model.
You know, a lot of what you're saying is over the head of some of our listeners. But what I find really interesting, because I mean, you deal mostly with ultra high net worth family offices, that kind of investor, right? Mm-hmm. But the one thing that I love about understanding this sector of the market is that it translates at all levels.
Of course.
You know, the average investor can be out there looking for this exact type of company and understanding what they're investing in instead of throwing darts at a board every time they're trying to buy stocks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it can be as simple as, you know, your kid sets up a lemonade stand, and then all of a sudden, you know, let's just make the math easy. They make $20 selling some lemonade, and you come in and say, okay, now you owe me $5 for the materials. Kid's not going to be very happy, but they'll at least understand cost of goods sold.
Well, you know, I always find it interesting. Anytime I look at investment as a whole, it all comes down to dollars and cents. Like when you talk numbers of billions of dollars here, you know, they've got market cap of $1 billion. When you're talking profits, you're talking about one item sold. I was watching a documentary on Junior's Cheesecake the other day because they're growing pretty, pretty rapidly. And they just moved out of New York. I think it was to Burlington, New Jersey is where they moved their plant. I just found it fascinating because as automated as it is, as growing as it is, I think it's $240 million a year or something like that. Every one of those cheesecakes has to produce a certain dollar amount of profit after expenses in order for that company to be profitable. Yeah, they're talking about $240 million of sales every year, but how much are they actually taking home?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've been studying the beverage can market. It seems simple and innocuous, right? I mean, everybody, you know, drinks a LaCroix or Coke or canned beer or whatnot. Like, it's pretty basic, right? But that market has gone, you know, in COVID, everyone was at home consuming product, and then the industry rapidly overbuilt capacity. And then now everyone's out of lockdown for the most part. And so the at-home consumption goes down. And the contribution margin, the last, you know, the profit in that industry is all in the last 20% of capacity utilized because it's such a competitive business. So it's something as innocuous as a beverage can manufacturer the earnings expectations can swing wildly because, you know, if the capacity utilization is 85, it's wildly different in profitability than 90 or 95. And it's actually stuff like that is where, you know, my team geeks out. But it, yeah, it's just simple business, right? Just simple beverage can.
No, I just always I find it very interesting. It all comes down to dollars and cents at the end of the day. Even if you're looking at like pension funds, it comes down to how much somebody's actually working and contributing hourly as an employee to a giant pension fund that's, you know, CalPERS investing in half the world right now. Let's take a step back for a minute because we kind of glazed over and got interested in the small cap stuff, but you talked about starting this fund by yourself. What was the process like that? What was the process of that like for you?
Well, it was aggressive. I was 29 when I launched, married, but no kids and no mortgage. And so it was a 3-year bet on myself. And, you know, I didn't take a salary for 3 years. So things got sort of thin there. I come from a nice family, but not a no trust fund to my name. So it was definitely a buying a call option on myself and being able to build not only the fund, the track record, but also the business. You know, I get asked a lot by young folks who are starting out, who are considering doing something like this, if they should do it or not. I'm very direct with them. And in fact, I kind of warn them before we talk. I'm like, look, I'm gonna be honest with you. You might not like to hear it. Just because like I made it to the other side does not mean that like the odds are in your favor. They're not. And so I just be very transparent with these folks because the fact of the matter is that like business is really hard and most businesses fail. And almost on a long enough time frame, almost every business goes, you know, goes out of business. So that's just the nature of, you know, capitalism as a system, this continuous, you know, what's next. So yeah, that was interesting. But now we're an SEC registered manager, which should tell you that we've grown from a one-man band to, you know, a wonderful team, and a number of clients have been with us for a long time. So there's a certain amount of entrepreneurial success there, even though we focus very hard on you know, serving our clients daily. But yes, we have, you know, we've come a long way from where we got started.
Well, just as a quick aside there to what you're saying, and everyone looks at, I'll say, the after. They look at, well, you're doing this, you're enjoying this success, but they don't understand, as you said, those lean years you had to go through where, I mean, I'm sure, and I've been there as well, and I understand that kind of, you're kind of like, all right, I got to put this dollar here to make sure that I don't bounce this to, all right, how do I navigate this month because this bill's due tomorrow, and I don't quite have the money in my account right now. And most people who are in business who've gone through that struggle, they've gone through that at least once, if not more times to get there.
Yeah, I guess it's a, you know, I got kids and I try and teach them, well, if you want something, you got to work for it. And part of working for it is, you know, luck matters. Sometimes you got to be good, smart, and lucky, you know, to kind of make your way. But it's not all luck, right? It's certainly you put yourself in a position to succeed. You put yourself in a position to have luck through just keeping on the focus. I love the name of your podcast, right? The Grind, right? So I mean that's what it is. When I got started, when I wasn't taking a salary, when I was, you know, I was building a product. I worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. And really for what I do, you almost cannot work more than 12 hours a day because at that point you're not actually like thinking. You're just sort of papering a file. But you know, that's what I did to get started. Now I got kids and I try to have a little bit more balance in my life now. So I no longer work that many hours, but I try to be very focused and specific with the hours that I have. We also have a wonderful team that you know serves our clients alongside me.
What were the things, just mindset wise, that got you through some of those? And I know
Get out of
Jeff
my
was probably
brain,
thinking the same.
Jonathan.
Yeah, just got you through some of those tough days. And obviously, you said you were married, so I'm sure there were a few, I'll say, discussions with your wife. And a big part is having somebody who supports you along the way. I know that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had also been working on Wall Street, and I had done an MBA. So in a lot of ways, I could have easily gone and got a job in many different investing firms or corporate America. So the downside was covered off in a lot of ways by the MBA. And of course, I couldn't have done it without, you know, my wife being fully in and bought in, and she was and is. And so that's been a huge blessing. But yeah, it's about putting yourself in a position to succeed, being radically honest and transparent with our investors, and not being, you know, I'm probably not a great salesperson with respect to, you know, like I've never been on CNBC. I'll probably never be on CNBC. That's not kind of what I do. But in terms of like putting up numbers and being radically transparent and honest with people about what we're seeing and what we can do and what we can't do, you know, that has made a lot of folks feel confident in what we've been doing for a long time now. So I'm proud of that.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Especially, I mean, 12 years is a huge accomplishment with any business. The numbers are staggering on how many don't make it out the first year. So good for you. Yeah. And I definitely know that the staying power of one's mindset, especially when you have a couple of failures and you see how easy it is to go back to a job as opposed to keep going and trying to build what you want for yourself. It's not easy all the time. It's not easy. So
it's kind of funny. Like if you have one business, okay, yeah, you have one business, but you also have not one boss like you do, or like I did when I came out of college. You have a whole bunch of bosses. They're called your clients, right? And you're serving them, and you're serving them in a way that if it's makes sense, they're going to stick with you and they're going to grow with you and recommend you to other people that they know and trust, you know, that trust circle expands. But if you do a poor job, then, you know, kind of all falls in on itself, at least in a service business, which is what I run. That's certainly part and parcel of it.
You know what? There's no difference between selling an investment fund or cutting someone's hair when it comes to customer service.
Absolutely. Yeah. Get the materials over as soon as you can in terms of, you know, be radically transparent with how you talk about what you're doing, the risks and the reward. You know, yeah. It's very easy for people to talk about the reward when things are going well, but, you know, and then have skin in the game. And we've just tried to do that, and we try to do that every day, and so far so good.
How do you handle, and this is always, it's always great, as you say, that risk reward. It's always great when times are going good. And you talk about transparency as well, but how do you handle those, I'll say, the tough conversations where things haven't gone as well? And that's how do you handle those things? And what's your approach with yourself and your team of I know from what you said, probably what it is, but how direct are you with people about these times?
Yeah, I mean, we had, you know, we were not positioned, say, for COVID early on. And we had some investments in the transportation sector and other economically sensitive businesses. So early on in COVID, we got walloped, right? And so I wrote a letter to our clients, and I said, look, I'm going to, as I always try and do, give you the information that I would want if the roles were reversed. If I was the client and you were managing the portfolio, what information would I want? And you kind of lay it out in a way that's balanced. I mean, you can be positive. Great, be positive. That's the whole job, right? Is to grow the asset value of people's portfolios. But you want to do it in a balanced way and not just blame things. Like, I didn't blame anyone for COVID. Like, hey, we didn't see it coming. We didn't understand the economic impact in January or February. And now here we are. And things are tough, and here's how we're going to get through it. And it was, you know, we laid it out point by point, and then by, you know, got the vaccine into the year, you know, and everything was just fine, right? Can't talk about numbers because we run a private fund, but everybody was just fine at the end of the year. So, you know, it's really about that communication and giving the information that people would want if the roles were reversed. I stole that, plagiarized from Warren Buffett. I think that's, but I also think it's a version of the golden rule, right? Which transcends, you know, a lot of things.
How did you handle your first loss?
Oh, well, huh. been losing my whole life. I grew up a student athlete. I grew up playing baseball, played in high school and college. And so, in baseball, you're doing great if you fail 65 times out of 100, right? 350, you'd be in the Hall of Fame. So you learn failure well playing sports. That's why I encourage people to play sports or games or, whatever it is. I think it develops personality and develops attributes. And I think, that's why I encourage my kids to pursue things of that ilk because, yeah, life is not easy. Life can be hard. It can be easy at times, but yeah, you want to take that adversity and then channel it, right? Bring it back into and make it fuel for the next game or the next day or the next iteration of the business.
You have any coaches or anything of that sort that you use for personal development?
I don't at the moment. I certainly have in the past, whether it's mentors or whatnot. I'm a person of faith, and so there are certain, scriptures and things that
Right
are,
beside me.
oh, there you go. Yep, that one. I do it more digitally these days, but that's an important part of who I am as a person, and so that is something that I try to have guide me. But yeah, certainly early on, especially if you got listeners who are, in their teens, 20s, or early 30s, I mean, yeah, find a mentor, I mean, there's some wonderful resources, especially now with technology, where you have access to people who are positive, who are driven, who are focused, right? And it doesn't have to be like a David Goggins, we're gonna run through a wall. It can be, sure, but you know what I mean? Like you gotta find what works for you. So
I just finished his what is it, Unbeatable, and it's a great story, but it's a little over the top. I am not going to run any ultra marathons anytime soon.
no, I'm more of a Jocko guy myself in the
Yeah, me too.
Fitness influencer category, but
No, that's no. I know that's helped me immensely. One of the things that I think is most important for any entrepreneur to understand is that people have done it before. I love talking to old people who've played the game. And we had a great guy on here a couple of weeks ago, Steve Selengut, and he started as a portfolio manager in the 70s, which was awesome. Like, that's how much have you seen in the market? And finding those people that even if you have one conversation with them, you can take so much from that conversation. By the way, I just wanted to mention, I hear your cat in the background every now and then. That actually brings a tear to my heart because I had to put down a cat this summer that she was always in the
Sorry,
background meowing.
I'm in the office 9 days out of 10, but I'm going over to my kid's school right after this to do a little Christmas thing. So
Okay.
yes, I am at home today.
No worries. The fact that you have animals shows you're a good person, because you can't have an animal without being a good person. So let's talk about that first year a little bit when you started coming up looking for companies and investors at the same time. That's a chicken and egg. How's that work?
Well, I don't think I did it well. I think I was so focused on putting up returns that I didn't focus on building the business as well as I should have. What I tell people now is if you want to start a fund, you want to find an anchor or two early on. So at least you're at a certain level of, the expenses of the fund and just general business requires a certain level of revenue. So I tell people not to launch like I did with a very de minimis amount of capital. I mean, like de minimis, I mean like less than $1 million, right? So, I do recommend people do it differently, but it can still be done. But it is the exception rather than the rule. Really before the financial crisis, it was a lot more common for things like this, and I'm maybe dating myself, but I started in the business before the financial crisis, so I kind of got it in my head and kind of wanted to scratch that itch at the time.
How do you find the companies that you're looking for? Like, do they come to you? Do you go to them? And, you know, kind of a two-parter here. Do you work with the management once you invest in them?
Yeah, great question. So we are actually constructive behind the scenes. We try and work with management and give them an unvarnished view of the company, and we earn that trust. The last company we invested in, we took out to our clients as actually an SPV. We did 150 slides, and the number of slides doesn't really do justice to, like, you can do a lot of slides with a lot of without a lot of impact, but we studied the business in a way that no one had done on their company ever in the public markets. And we gave them all of our information, and we gave them, here are the warts of your company, and here are, the shining diamonds, aspects of the business. And here's what the information that we see. And if we're wrong, tell us. But with Reg FD, tell everyone in the market at the same time. And tell them, publicly and in a general, forum. And so managers tend to not get that level of feedback. Usually investors, it's not our job to give, our job is to decipher whether management is telling us reasonable information or not, or decipher the growth of the company and then act in the market, but not communicate. So, compare and contrast, that's a bit of a unique style. We're not activists. We don't come in and start yelling at management and telling them what to do. I'm friends with a lot of those guys. A lot of them are really smart and have done a lot of good work for investors. And there's certainly agency issues in small caps. Small caps have some of the worst managements and boards that you can believe. And that's north of the border, south of the border, everywhere. That's global. That's just the nature of the beast. But we don't focus on those. We focus on those that care about shareholder value, that care about delivering returns and growing their businesses. Like everything I was talking about earlier, unit economics and whatnot. So, that's something that that we look for. We have 800 folders of small caps that we've looked at over the past 12 years. I mean, our pencil's not sharp on 800 companies at the moment, but we very much sharp on a couple hundred for sure. I mean, we have a great team that's been doing it a long time. We've all been doing small caps more or less our whole career. So yeah, that's a lot of exposure. We're also friends with the small cap community is not huge. So we're friends with, a lot of different folks, and we share notes and whatnot. So
Now, what's kind of your app? Sorry, go ahead, Jonathan.
no, you go ahead. You're first.
Well, I was just gonna ask, what's kind of your like average allocation size?
We have 20 longs and 40 shorts at any one time, give or take. So about 5% would be a core position. A large position for us would be something like 8-9%. So
No, it's that. Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, Jonathan. Your turn.
I was going to ask, you talked about sort of bringing forward, hey, here's your analysis of the company effectively to the company. Would you do that before you invest with them, or is that after you've got an investment with them?
Yeah, it's after. I mean, the amount of time required to put something together like that, we it's exhaustive. And I don't mean that to like try and pat ourselves on the back or something. That's just our process. That's what we do on behalf of our clients. In terms of sharing it with them, that's a little bit newer. It's not with every company. The companies need to be open to it. And they need to care. Most might be punitive, but many don't care. They don't, they're like, well, look, you're a public market investor. If you don't like us, don't buy the stock. End of story. And that's fine, but if I can help them do their job better and they can explain the company better and it's a better valuation, stock price goes up. Management's happy, the board is happy, the employees are happy. M many of them have stock in a company. Customers see that the company is having success. It's a virtuous cycle, right? So many companies struggle with narrative, especially if they're focused on operational and commercial performance. And they struggle with telling their story. They're a better actor than a storyteller, and that's their job, is to run the business, right? So, there's no finishing school for CEOs that can encapsulate all the aspects of their businesses. So when someone like us comes along and tries to add value in a collaborative and constructive manner, we've found that many management teams and boards are open to it. So those we like to help and engage, and those that aren't interested, we just move on. There's a lot of fish in the sea.
And does that help, I guess, determine if you're going to stay with this company on a longer term basis, or if this is a short term investment based on how open are they to your feedback?
For us, price and value, when price and value converge, we're going to be out. That could be 6 months, and we've got one that we've been in for 7 years. That business has continued. It's a long story. It was definitely affected by COVID, whatnot. But price and value converge, and we're out, and we're on to the next. And we're very candid with folks, and even businesses where we've presented to the board and been very open with them. I call them up when we sell, and I just say, "Hey, look, it's my job to sell it, at a certain point," and they understand that. And I tell them, thank them for what they did, and a lot of times we'll be back, right? Things happen in the world. The macro economy changes, investor perceptions change, and businesses change, all three, all the time, right? So we've invested multiple times in companies, and they're happy to see us back. So usually, not always. Some people don't want to hear what we have to say, but we try and keep our mouth shut in that case.
You can't love everyone. Sorry, you just into the way that you explained that, it's just something I've never really not understood, just never thought about in the market is being,
Yeah.
5% is a pretty large chunk of a company, and the fact that when you sell, it's like breaking up with a partner. Like you guys have been partnered for the last 6 months to 4 years, and now it's time to end that. It's just interesting. I never really thought of it like that. I mean, it's not quite a partnership, but the fact that you call them and have
Yeah.
that conversation is fascinating to me.
Well, we sell in the market, right? So in a way, it's a third party. I don't know who's on the other side of a trade when I buy or sell, usually in the public market. But yeah, I mean, that it is a little unique. But where we're trying to connect with these folks. But if you think about it from a capital allocation standpoint, if you're a shareholder of a public company, you're trusting management and the board to allocate your capital in a way that's efficient and productive. And most people don't think about public businesses like that, because it's like a stock ticker, and it goes up and it goes down, and that's what it is. But it's
Boom.
not just that. It's so much more. It's a set of operating assets and people and culture and ingrained knowledge. And so when you think about the businesses like that, as opposed to just being a stock that goes up or down randomly, seemingly, then you kind of think about it in a lot of a different way. So for me, we choose that methodology to think about business.
I think that's absolutely mind-blowing, to be honest with you, because a lot of times when we talk to, full disclosure, we've worked more with like PE and real estate.
Yep.
Stocks are not really our well, Jonathan's probably had a lot more experience than I have. I've owned a few, but it's always about the numbers and the charts and channeling, and they're really not thinking about anything other than numbers. When you're talking about people. And understanding that,
Yeah.
right down to that, are the employees happy, or do they come in dragging their ass every day and they don't, production's down and morale sucks, and all those things are massive factors when it goes when you talk about profit.
Yeah, and those are things you can learn for most companies now with the internet. So you just got to kind of turn over a few more rocks.
No, that's I'm sorry. I just never thought of it that way. You give me a completely new perspective. I love when that happens. That's my absolute favorite thing about this show is just having conversations with people like you that, hey, you know what? There's a perspective in the world that I haven't explored yet. So thank you very much for that. What is your outlook for the coming year? Do you think these interest rates are going to go down and start driving businesses a little higher? Do you think it's all like, if you talk to some people, there should have been a correction by now.
Well, it was funny. I was thinking, you mentioned talking to someone in the 70s, someone who was operating in the 70s. I'm 41, and my entire life, not just my business career, interest rates have gone in one direction until, a year and a half ago, right? So you have this multi-decade, it encapsulates the entire career of a couple generations of investors where inflation and interest rates are going one way and now they're going the other way. I don't think anyone really knows, right?
No, of
The
course not.
negative implications of rising rates to it could be mortgages in places like Canada and the UK, right? Plus, everything that's going on with onshoring and de-globalization is massively inflationary, and no one's talking about that. No one's talking about peak oil out a couple. You know what I mean? Like, so to answer your question, I don't know, right? And that makes for probably a terrible soundbite, but I think it's honest, right? Like, I don't anyone who thinks they know what the economy is going to do if the U.S. Federal Reserve takes interest rates to 2% is probably deluding themselves, because if they take it to 2% because the economy is falling off the cliff, that's not bullish for stocks. Earnings are going down, and guess what? Stocks are going to go down too. But if it's a soft landing, if earnings are going up and inflation just kind of peters down, I would just say that go back and study economic history. There's been soft landing calls at the beginning of almost every recession in the last 50 years. So for us, we're not making a bet one way or another. We're just kind of trying to look for dramatically mispriced companies, companies that are inflecting earnings, and hopefully the vicissitudes of the economic cycle will kind of wash out for us as we invest in companies.
No, I think having that sound principle behind you too is going to carry you through any kind of financial tumult that may or may not be coming. I mean, if you're investing in good companies that are profitable right now, why wouldn't they be profitable if the economy takes a downturn? Like you talked about the canned beverage market. Well, when people are a little more upset, they drink a lot more. So if things go down, those are kind of recession-proof businesses, right?
Like to think so. I mean, you brought up beverage cans. Beverage cans, the biggest drawdown in the Great Financial Crisis was 4% on a unit volume basis. So in North America, 4% decline when the markets were down 50, right? So yeah, there are certain businesses that should be just fine.
So we've got a few minutes left in the show here. Why don't we talk to what you're looking for your key investor base? Like, who are you looking for?
Oh, for our client base, for
Yeah.
us, we serve family offices, institutions, and high net worth investors. We don't have a large media profile. We're not, well known because we focus on got our nose in the books, studying companies and out meeting companies and trying to understand changes in their products and services. So, for us, we're looking for long-term focused, long-term oriented folks, but folks who, may need liquidity. We don't run a private equity firm, right? We're not going to lock capital for 10 years. Capital does come and go from our fund based on people's needs, and that's as it should be. So we provide one good investing option. There are many, but that has a certain amount of liquidity, but it's definitely not a day-to-day kind of thing.
Sorry, I should have asked this earlier when it was actually in line with other questions, but how long is your due diligence process typically?
On a company? Well, a lot of these companies I was talking to a CEO of a carbon black manufacturer yesterday. And I have followed that company since they went public in 2014. And we made our first investment in that company in 2019, and we're still in it. So that's one extreme. The other extreme is there's a newer company, a newer IPO. We follow it, for a couple quarters, and all of a sudden, stock's down based on something, or the products are inflecting based on something else, and we can pull the trigger fairly quickly. There's a lot of research that you can do by, studying industries, studying companies. Companies are, actors within industries, and a lot of people bounce around. You can't talk to many people who work at the company trying to study, but you can talk to formers, and that's a great, you talk to someone who was there for 10 years when it was a private company, and you can understand a little bit more about the culture, a little bit more about the capital allocation, a little bit, you talk to five or six of those people, and you've got a pretty good history of that business, even though you yourself haven't been following it for those years. You can get a sense of a company and kind of frame it out from an economic perspective. It's 80-20, right? But if the price is cheap enough, you might only need 80-20, right? And then you'll finish out the diligence for sure. But if the price is, if you're buying something at a 20 to 25% free cash flow yield and it's a growing business, you're going to be just fine.
So, sorry, I'm just trying to word this. Do you think it's a good time for companies like yours to be using leverage, NAV
No,
loans,
I don't use
HEB loans?
leverage.
No, why not?
Because any compounded number multiplied by zero is zero.
Can you put that into like just plainer terms? Because
Oh,
I
yeah, like you're rolling craps, you can roll them, and then you crap out and it's gone, right? I mean, you got it's it. If you're operating in an investing capacity, what you care about most is your value at the end of the game, and you have to be in the game to play the game. So you can never bet. There's the Kelly Growth Criterion is a wonderful formula that helps people size bets. I'm not a betting person. I guess in a certain way, there's probabilities involved, but we like to play positive sum games and games with a positive expected probability weighted outcome. But Kelly Growth Criterion, I wrote a whole white paper on it in terms of like how do you use it in public stocks, because Kelly Growth Criterion just tells you in a win or lose situation. Well, in a public security, the price is going up and down every day. So anyway, all you want to do is not take yourself out of the game and manage your risk, and the results to the upside will take care of themselves. You do it for a while and the numbers add up kind of quickly, right? Exponential growth all comes at the end, right? And people don't think exponentially, they think linearly. So
No, that's fantastic. Well, we are at the end of our time here. I want to be respectful to your time, and I know Jonathan's got to call it too. Thank you so much, Kyle. Is there anything you want to leave the audience with?
no, I appreciate your time. It was nice to connect with you guys. Happy to come back in a while and see if there's
Absolutely.
anything that's interesting in our world and help you guys as you continue on the grind.
Yeah, fantastic. How do folks find you?
We got a website. We got an email address. It's kyle@grizzlyrockcapital.com. We're also on Twitter on our single name investing business at Covest Select.
And it's X now.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Wow. Hey, I'm in Chicago. I still call it the Sears Tower. It has been the Sears Tower in forever. So it's
Really?
yeah, it's the Willis Tower, this insurance company. So
Oh, that's funny. I didn't even know that. Awesome. Jonathan, anything you want to say to wrap it up?
Kyle, it's been fun talking with you today. I'm actually someone who used to be really involved in just personal stock trading years ago. I'm not super involved in it nowadays, but it's always fun to go back in
Sure.
you can probably tell from some of my questions, start geeking out a little bit going back into,
Sure.
oh yeah, I love this stuff. I love this stuff. There's a part of me that loves it, but at the same time, I'm just focused on other things, so I don't have the time to go
Right.
into it. But glad to hear you're out there doing that. Love what you're doing. Love your approach. I mean, getting into small cap was something I never really got into just because I didn't have the time to delve into it, but
Sure.
very, very exciting talking to you.
Yeah, it's time intensive, but yeah, appreciate you guys' time. Happy holidays and happy new year.
Yeah, absolutely. Same to you. Thanks so much for being here, Kyle. Really appreciate your time. Thank you, Jonathan, and thank you for listening. If you made it this far, please do us a favor. Give us a like, a share, a comment. All those things really help with the algorithms and get us out there. Obviously, we're sharing a lot of great information from very intelligent people, far people far smarter than myself, as you can tell by the intro from this show. If you want to know more about what Jonathan and I do, you can go to guidetothegrind.com. Once again, gentlemen, thank you very much for being here, Kyle. Thank you, Jonathan. Go to grizzlyrockcapital.com to learn more about what they're doing. Thank you very much. Happy New Year. Merry Christmas. We'll see you in the new year. Thanks so much for watching. Talk to you soon.
Cheers.